This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joyce Carol Oates is an incredibly prolific writer, the author of 23 novels, as well as many short stories and essays. She's covered a lot of territory, from a reworking of the romance novel to a book about boxing. Her new novel, Foxfire, is about the members of a girl gang in a small upstate New York town in the 1950s. They take a blood oath and swear never to betray each other. They think of themselves as a true sisterhood, not just the girl version of crude boy gangs. The Foxfire Gang finds its mission to take revenge against the men who sexually harass them. The story is told by the now 50-year-old woman who was a member of the gang and served as its chronicler. When Oates was growing up in upstate New York, she went to school with some tough girls. She stayed on the outside observing, but she could imagine the attraction of being in a gang.
Oh, it's very intense, and it has its romantic underpinnings, I think, in early adolescence, particularly for girls who are from broken homes or from impoverished neighborhoods. It's basically what we all want, a sense of some communal solidarity, a sense that somebody loves you, a sense of sisterhood. The friendships of young girls, I think, are perhaps the most intense of all friendships.
What do you think that is?
Because they're new. When we're 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, we're making friendships of a kind we've never made before. Everything is very fresh and new and very, very emotional. The rises and dips, the ups and downs of these relationships is extremely passionate.
The girls in the gang in your novel organize against men who try to fondle them. Men are the enemy. Why have you made men the enemy?
Well, it isn't men really in the beginning so much as a need that the girls feel for protection against those who have power. They themselves don't have power. It happens to be men who have power, teachers and older boys. It isn't so much that they're men, so much as that power resides with them. And when we're powerless, we need to band together with others to protect ourselves. I think the issue of sexuality comes a little later in the novel.
I think a lot of girls in their young teens get really obsessed with boys. How did you see that figuring into the girls in your novel?
Well, these girls are reacting against that. Obviously, all around them, they see other girls who are obsessed with boys, and they've had experiences with older sisters or, say, their mothers. We get the sense that Maddie's mother may have had very unhappy or even disastrous sexual relations with men, and Legs's mother obviously did. The marriage was very unhappy. So they're really reacting against that. But I wanted also, in the larger sense, to be critiquing the feminist idea of excluding men, because as the girls' gang evolves, as the years pass, and they become more and more fanatic, it becomes a sort of monomaniacal ideal to exclude men, and that brings about the end of the gang. It's not that I am myself a feminist, but I was really hoping to put that ideal to the test. That is, if you posit men as the enemy, then you're making a grave mistake, and eventually your idealism will crumble.
Mm-hmm. Well, you often write about teenage girls. Why are you so interested in that period of life?
Well, I write about people of all ages, actually, and I do write a good deal about adults, and I write about men.
Mm-hmm.
So I do.
Because you write enough, you could cover everybody.
Yeah, right. I'm just very interested in adolescence because I see it as such a passion and a romantic time. I remember my own adolescence very well. When I go back to Lockport, New York, as I was just doing last week, and I walked around some of the same streets and saw the Erie Canal and the locks and some of the settings for Foxfire, actually. All these old emotions come sweeping back and sort of flooding into my heart, and I feel this sense of a childlike excitement at the prospect of life, even though, in fact, I'm extremely mature and I'm a professor at Princeton University. It's as if I'm transported back to some other time.
What were your passions, your obsessions, your fears when you were a young girl growing up in Lockport, in Millersport?
Well, I feel that I can't really talk that much about myself. I feel a little self-conscious. But Maddie, the narrator in my novel, and other characters in novels of mine, like You Must Remember This and Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, obviously overlap very much with my own experiences and many of my thoughts about life, my sentiments, my philosophy, and so forth. I put a good deal of myself in these characters. But there's a margin of my own self, naturally, since I am an adult, I am a professor, and I'm a writer, that margin of myself is not in the novels. That is, I'm writing about girls who are not myself.
Mm-hmm. Some of your novels and stories have to do with violence, and you know, there's some violence in your new novel, and it seems to me that you yourself are somebody who is a person who probably lives more in her mind, do you know what I mean, than in a really big physical way. You don't strike me as somebody who would be violent.
No, I think most people are probably not violent until something happens. They may be put to the test.
Yet you're obviously really interested in people who are.
I wrote a book on boxing. So
right.
I saw,
yes.
This is the quintessential masculine sport, which makes violence a kind of aesthetic activity.
Can you explain your interest in violence? Is it because of its dramatic quality, or is it something other than that?
Well, all writers write about violence. I think it's mainly the case that women writers have not characteristically written about it. Women have, through the centuries, women have tended to write about domestic events, or like Virginia Woolf, they write about a very rarefied kind of experience. So women have been typecast as not writing about certain subjects, but of course, as we all know, the sexes can do anything. I mean, men can write about childbirth and domestic life, and women can certainly write about war. There have been wonderful women journalists writing about Vietnam and women photographers taking photographs of wartime, like Margaret Burke White. So I think it's mainly that I'm asked questions about violence that Ernest Hemingway or Norman Mailer would not have been asked because they're men.
I'd ask them. Because I ask men who write about violence all the time and always ask them about it.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think they probably would say, and what anybody would say through the centuries, whether it's Homer or Shakespeare or Dostoevsky, that one is writing not about violence so much as the motives that lead into it, the complex psychological network that makes violence a part of life. And then also, very much in my case, I read about the aftermath of violence, the consequences for women and children who have been the victims of violence. It's not that I'm writing about violence per se or celebrating it, but I very often do write about the consequences.
You've written a little bit about violence in your own family. You had a short memoir piece in the New York Times a while back. That told in part about how your father's grandfather tried to kill your father's grandmother and then shot himself instead. Is that a story that's had a kind of really big impact on your family?
Not really, so far as I know, because it never was told to me until I was an adult. I think I was in my 40s before I heard that.
Oh, so you were already a writer when you heard that.
Yes, well, I think most family sagas that have anything a little bit sinister about them are not told. The children grow up without knowing them. The adults may make allusions to them, and there may be a kind of atmosphere of something repressed. But no, I didn't know about that. Then my mother's father was actually murdered, and she was given away. So I'm from a world in which violence had definite consequences for both my parents, really made their lives. It radically lessened the freedom and possibility of their lives.
Did you say your mother was given away?
Well, she was given away to relatives, but there were so many children in the family. I think there were 9, and she was just a baby. Well, they're very poor. I mean, we're talking about extremely poor people in a time where there wasn't public welfare assistance. I mean, we're really talking about a long time ago, like the early 20th century.
How old were you when you found out about that story?
That story, gee, I was probably well into my 30s. These things are not talked about very much, and since I did write about it, I suppose it's become public, but I do rather wince at it. Sometimes we write things in the solitude of a study. I was writing about my father, and this came out in my writing. You know, you sit alone in your study, and you're writing out of some passion to tell the truth, and then years go by, and suddenly what you've written has become really in the public domain, and it's still you can't quite believe it, that you ever really said that.
Yeah, tell me the difference about that feeling that it's your job as a writer to tell the truth, but the conflicting feeling in an interview that it's your job to kind of withhold the truth when it's personal.
Well, it's really a matter of finding the right language for it. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the essay on my father, I spent weeks on it, and I really worked it over and I calibrated all the language and had him read it, and I thought a lot about it, so it came out really like a kind of prose poetry. But when one is speaking spontaneously, one doesn't have that margin for, obviously, you know, for thinking and premeditating and so forth. So I think one feels much less in control. That if I could put certain truths in the right linguistic context, then they come out a little more truthful, in a matter of fact. But if one speaks sort of bluntly, it can come out of context and careen and veer along and seem almost untruthful.
And be misunderstood.
Be misunderstood.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joyce Carol Oates, and she's written a new novel called Foxfire. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Joyce Carol Oates is my guest. Were you writing as a teenager?
Yes, I've always been writing, really, as long as I can remember.
What were you writing about?
I suppose I was writing about being a teenager. I was probably writing about some of my own experiences and living out in the country. And I had the occasion of rereading a story of mine, my first published story that was in a high school literary magazine. Somebody is doing an anthology of the first published stories by American writers. And so he located the story for me and said, would you mind if I reprinted it? So I read it, and I had not seen it for 40 years, and I was really astounded by it. I didn't remember it very well.
Were you embarrassed, or did you feel proud?
Well, as I said, I didn't remember it very well. I think I would have been quite astounded if a student of mine had written that story. It just seemed to have so much detail in it, and, in a way, I was strangely impressed by it. I was almost a little amazed at it. I wouldn't have thought I could have written that well at that age, which would be about 16. I mean, it just did surprise me.
Well, good. a lot of us have the experience of going back and reading earlier stuff, and it's incredibly embarrassing.
Well, writers are always a little bit concerned, maybe all artists are a little bit concerned that what they've done in the past is comes out of a place in them that they don't have access to anymore.
Oh, and that they've lost something forever.
You've lost something forever. Certainly you've lost a sense of wonder and naivete. We tend to think that we gain in technique and control as we lose a sense of energy. I used to be able to write a short story all the way through as a first draft, say 25 pages, and then go back and rewrite it. Now I could never do that. I could never write 25 pages straight through.
You're still incredibly prolific.
But I'm not, I don't have that kind of energy. I do a lot of revising. In fact, 90% of what I do is revision. Very careful. I type over and over again. I don't have a word processor. I just work over and over again, each paragraph, each page. But I do remember when I was much younger, I could just go through and write about 30 pages, be very exhausted. And then the next day, I would rewrite it. I would do the revision.
Why don't you use a computer?
I did have one for a couple of years. Well, as I said, I do so much revision that it's easier just to be on a typewriter so I can see it. I would have to be printing out constantly. I do most of my writing is done in longhand anyway, and then I transfer it to the typewriter. Mm-hmm. I don't think it really matters the way in which we write. It's more the way the mind is processing the language.
Were you the first person in your family to go to college?
I was the first person to graduate from high school.
Oh. What was that very significant in the family?
I suppose it was. I don't have any memory of it being. I've always been fairly modest about my own self, and I admire my parents enormously. They weren't able to go to high school and college because of the Depression. They had to work, and they had a very difficult life of a kind that people today probably don't know about. That is, my students, being born so much later in the 20th century, just don't have any knowledge at all of the Depression and how that changed people's lives. As I said earlier, Terry, it really represented a violent curtailing of the freedom and possibility of my parents' lives. I mean, they might have both gone to college. My father in particular has always been interested in music, and he might have done something in music, but that was never an option. He was working when he was 12 years old.
So college got you away from home?
Very much, yes, but I've been very close to my parents. I'm still close to my parents.
The house that you grew up in, I think, doesn't exist anymore?
No, the house doesn't, but my parents have built a smaller house on the same land, the same plot of land.
Oh, so you still have a place to go home to that would recall the childhood memories?
Oh, absolutely. I was just there last week.
I didn't realize that the plot of land is still there, too.
My mother's lived on the same plot of land for about 75 years. The same land. That's that generation. It's a very different situation for most Americans today, where Americans are always in motion.
You have a sister who's autistic and has been institutionalized since her adolescence. I guess I'm wondering what it was like for you, as someone who lives so much in a world of language and writing, to have a sibling whose condition prevents them from communicating.
Oh, I've thought about it so much. I've written a little poem about it. I wanted to write more about it, but all that came out was a poem of about 12 lines. That's really all I could get into language. I think it's so hard to articulate our thoughts about certain subjects because we don't want to seem superficial or glib. We don't want to seem to be exploitative, certainly. So I haven't said much about it, really. I was 18 when my sister was born, and I was going away to college. She was born on my birthday, which is June 16th, and she actually looks very much like me, but she's never uttered a coherent sentence. She's locked in this world of autism, which we know to be caused by some sort of biochemical imbalance in the brain. And medical technology is really experimenting and making good inroads into the problem. But my sister's autism is very extreme. It's not at all like the autism of Dustin Hoffman's movie Rain Man.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman was at the far end of autism, that is almost normal. On a scale of 1 to 10, he would be 10, whereas my sister would be about 1 or 2.
Do you visit her? Do you see her?
No, I haven't seen her in a long time. She wouldn't know me. She wouldn't recognize anyone. I think, she knows my parents, I think.
Do you remember the poem? Is it something you could, like, recite for us?
Well, I could possibly stumble through it, but I think I'd rather not. I think the final line is just something about, to know you, sister, is not my privilege. That I can't know her, no matter how I contemplate her and write about her and think about her. Ultimately, it's a mystery. It's just a profound mystery.
You started publishing in the 60s. As a woman writer then, was being a woman ever held against you or ever used as a way to discourage you from pursuing writing?
Oh, absolutely. There was no women's liberation at that time and really no consciousness of women being equal to men in any way. It was really felt that those of us who wrote about male subjects like politics or society and indeed crime and violence, that was really felt that I was transgressing or trespassing into some male domain.
Now, how was that told to you?
Well, I would see it in reviews. I remember one headline, which was the headline over a very negative review of a play of mine, and the headline was Detroit Housewife Writes a Play. And I, at that time, I was a professor at the University of Detroit. I was a professional woman with a job, and it happened that I was a married woman. But can you imagine today, Detroit housewife writes a play or writes a novel. The word housewife was used pejoratively, and the idea of the headline, which was in the Detroit News, I think, was that the audacity of a housewife to write a play or a novel, and this is something that shouldn't be ridiculed, then the review was very negative.
When did you first become aware of the women's movement?
I was involved with a friend of mine named Patricia Burnett, was a national officer in NOW, the National Organization of Women, when it was just being organized back in the 1970s. And Patricia Burnett was and is my friend. I knew her very well then. Since then, we haven't seen each other very much in the years since I've left Detroit. But so I was involved very much.
How did it change you?
Oh, that's like Foxfire, where the girls get together and they realize that each one of them had seemed to be alone and seemed to be isolated. And her sense of inadequacy or her fears or her disappointments or terrors had seemed to be very idiosyncratic and individual. And then she gets together with other girls, as they do in Foxfire, and realizes that these are shared. So too with women in the 1970s, the 1960s and 1970s, that we saw ourselves mirrored in one another, and we could be encouraging to one another. And this always was a sense of elation, I think, and happiness. It wasn't that women got together to be very negative about men or to be critical of men. Not at all. The feeling that I got was one of energy, and it was energizing.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joyce Carol Oates' new novel is called Foxfire, Confessions of a Girl Gang. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.